Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, I'm Hannes. I'm here in London today with Michelle Frost. I work as a principal consultant for a company called Axis in Belgium. We're going to be talking about ethics in AI, but first I'll allow Michelle to introduce herself.
Thank you. As Hannes said, my name is Michelle Frost. I'm an AI advocate at JetBrains. I started my career in machine learning in 2017, started digging into ethical implications of machine learning and AI about 6 years ago, and then completed last year a Master's of Science in AI at Johns Hopkins.
So you're well established in this field, and I have so many questions because as a developer, I look at AI and I see all these problems, and I'm told that in your industry, they call this the alignment problem, trying to find two different angles in AI and balancing between them. For instance, when it comes to things like bias, things like performance, there's always a whole bunch of factors to take into account. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, and first I'll back up a little bit and tell you that, you know, the field has been changing a lot. There are fewer experts than you would think. I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out things as we go together and try and help each other make the right decisions. And when it comes to, you know, ethics operating in AI, values, right? So as humans, we have a set of values. Mm-hmm. Everyone you meet believes in something. And for every belief that a person holds, there's an opposing belief. And I won't get into whether one of them is right or wrong, but we see the same thing in AI. It's very human intertwined. It's very closely related to our own beliefs. So the value alignment problem in AI is basically trying to find, as ethicists, what is the middle ground of each of these conflicting values. So you mentioned, for example, bias. And oftentimes when we look in the field of fairness, which is the mitigation of bias, for many models that are based off of historically biased data, in order to increase fairness, then sometimes accuracy takes a hit. Right. So do you prioritize model performance or do you prioritize fairness? Or in another instance, privacy versus security. A lot of like facial recognition technologies we could look at sit into this category. So should, you know, CCTV cameras be able to immediately know who you are? There's a security level for that, right? Mm-hmm. There's national security being prioritized, but at the risk of individual privacy.
Exactly. So when you look at these trade-offs, I'm assuming that there's no one-size-fits-all for any application. Right? This is always something that needs to be reevaluated for everything that you built with AI, or?
Yeah, and there's a couple different frameworks for going about this, but you know, the thing that we always have to answer is it depends.
Right.
Anytime someone asks a question in this field, it's truly it depends. Because it depends on the company, on the product, on the industry it operates within, in the surrounding regulations or maybe lack thereof of the political climate of the government that the product operates in, or its users in the case of different, you know, US companies that also have users in the EU.
Also, maybe the nature of the source data might be one of the things that warrants mm-hmm. certain approaches, especially if you're dealing with medical records, for instance, or whatever, that all will play into that.
It depends.
It all depends. Well, but we live in interesting times. Now, for you as a viewer, like this interview takes place at the end of January 2025, which means that Trump has just taken office and there's a whole bunch of interesting things happening. We've had an announcement of Project Stargate that's going to lead to considerable investments in AI. DeepSeek is a thing that is popping up just today, literally. And of course, deregulating AI in the US. Let's maybe start there. A lot of the previous AI regulations have been lifted as one of the first acts that Trump has done after taking office. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Maybe we'll back up for a little bit and look at what the previous administration, Biden, did too.
Sure.
So yes. In, I think it was 2023, I'm going to misquote myself, 2021 perhaps, first was introduced the AI Bill of Rights. Okay. What should we be doing as a country to start investigating the different types of harm that could come from AI? Considering innovation, right? We still want to enable innovation, but we also need to anticipate the risks and create regulations that kind of create guardrails.
Right.
And so then in 2023, Biden's AI executive order was signed. There was also quite a bit of funding put into NIST, the National Institute of Standards for Technology. And NIST actually has been truly a leader the last few years of creating different frameworks for example, bias evaluation and mitigation, for human-centered design and AI processes. So there was quite a bit of movement happening the last few years in the US for AI regulation and for prioritizing ethical development of AI. And day one of the Trump administration, that all pretty much got put on pause and seems to be thrown out the window. On the 20th, which was the first day of his administration, he repealed 50 different executive orders of the previous administration, basically saying they needed to be reviewed. One of them was the AI executive order. The next day, there was then a new Trump era EO that basically stated AI development should be free from social agendas. And I can't remember the exact wording on it, but basically stating that AI development should be free from social agendas, which we have different ideas of what a social agenda is. So, yes. Interpret that as your will. And then on the 23rd of January, the Stargate project was announced that it was going to receive about $500 billion in funding. And the stakeholders, 40% is OpenAI, 40% is SoftBank.
Right. Now, that's a lot to take in. And I think it's pretty safe to say that we're going to see lots of movement in the field of AI. What do you think is the biggest risk of the deregulation that has just happened?
Well, it has been very interesting because responsible AI in the last few years has become a bit of a hype term in and of itself.
Right.
At the risk of maybe upsetting a few people, I'll make a statement that in the last year, I've really seen quite a bit of checkboxes happening, very similar to the 2020 DE&I checkbox, where you have to really decide as an individual, does this company truly care about responsible AI practices, or are they responding to public interest and kind of the broader schema of what's been happening? Mm-hmm. And already with the Trump administration, we're seeing a lot of corporations across the states pulling back their DE&I efforts. So it's likely to follow that, the same AI standards that if they've adopted, will do the same, which is, it's going to really put it onto individual corporations, number one, to decide, do they care about ethics in AI? Do they care about trying to align their values with their development? And then at the consumer level of, as a consumer, I have the power to put pressure on companies to say, I will, support you if you meet my values. Mm-hmm. And AI is going to take a play in that as well.
Yeah. And in the past, we've seen, not just in the field of AI, that if you want to push for DE&I, if it doesn't come from a higher authority, mm-hmm. like big corporations are often not very motivated to mm-hmm. take steps in, let's say, the right direction in that matter. So that's not really hopeful then. Is there a good side to it as well?
Yeah, so I will back up too and say there is going to have to be short-term actions taken. And you will see companies take them. The risk with that too is a lack of standardization.
Right.
So if every company has its own set of rules, it's hard enough when we're deciding between different governing bodies, let alone individual corporations. The benefit, of course, people will advocate for is economic advancement, is innovation without strings attached. There are valid arguments on that, just like we mm-hmm. talked about the value conflict alignment issue. On every side, of these issues, there is a valid argument on each.
Yes.
I think, you know, for me personally, we often looked to tomorrow and tried to predict the problem that is going to come tomorrow. So, you know, AGI has been such a buzzword the last few years. Is AI coming for my job? Is AI going to do...
Is AI coming for my job?
You know, I think that might be another episode more later on. but we have a lot of fears of tomorrow, of next week. And yet we've had a lot of these issues for years, if not decades, in machine learning, in more old school AI that we still haven't addressed and solved. So in some ways, I think that it's a distraction from problems that we still have that need to be addressed.
Right. So you're basically balancing like the technical advancements of what AI models can do technically and what science goes on behind that versus solving the problems with the current type of models that are clearly still there, but that haven't been solved yet.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that this is really a socio-technical problem, right? The history of AI is deeply connected to the history of humans.
Right.
So all of these issues that we're talking about, they're really human problems. And now we're amplifying them with a certain technology that is expediting and speeding up some of them. Mm-hmm. But the problem seems to try and be solved, you know, either solely in policy or solely on the tech side, solely in regulation and lawyers, but it really needs the all-encompassing
all of
team.
These parties to invest in the problem if we're ever going to make meaningful advancements there. All right. Now, we see that using AI responsibly leads to some great things. As a programmer, for instance, what I see is like having tools that help me write code, understand code, like all that sort of stuff. That is fantastic, and it increases productivity. From my point of view, I don't think AI is going to take my job anywhere soon, because I truly believe that understanding the business problem is not something that AI is good at the moment. But there's definitely some jobs in the tech industry that might be affected, especially when you see a lot of offshoring jobs. That is typically work that is very well spec'd out, and then the programming happens somewhere else. That is very, let's say, thinking poor jobs or like low on the... It requires very little insights from the persons doing the job. Mm-hmm. I think those jobs might be affected, right? What other fields do you see big impacts coming from these AI models that we may have to be aware of?
Yeah, you know, forecasting is something that we've always gotten wrong. I can no longer make the weather analogy because they're actually pretty decent at that now.
Yeah, there's good models for that.
There's good models for that. But when it comes to, you know, shifts in labor and what automation is going to take away, historically, we've gotten it wrong. So I could make some assumptions, but also every time we make an advancement in a certain model, it changes the game. So we're trying to make predictions in a shifting landscape, and we're also trying to build software in the shifting landscape, and that's hard.
Yes.
In some respects, we've always been doing that, but this one moves a little bit faster.
That's why we have agile, right?
Yeah, hopefully. Agile-ish.
Agile-ish.
So I think I've seen quite a bit of social, how would you say this? Like restaurant workers even,
right,
or store clerks. There is a human element there, but for the most part, it's a transaction.
Right.
I look at a menu, I say, hey, could I please have XYZ and, you know, this to drink? And there's a transaction that happens. Now, there's a human element too that I think some people would automatically say, well, actually, you know, I go into a restaurant so that I can have some sort of social interaction or element, even if it's just interacting with a server.
Right.
However, that is, you know, a field that has been identified as one that is possible to be replaced.
Right.
I think that that is going to really come down to a company and, like, for example, at a restaurant level, how they want their image to be. Do you want to come in and interact with some sort of automated thing? Probably not. Now, other jobs, you know, like you mentioned earlier, deciding distribution shifts, right? What do we send here? What do we send here? We have models for that now.
Right.
Or the transportation of goods. from developers, you know, we get asked this a lot, is AI going to take my job? Is AI going to code for me? You mentioned it already. The abstraction of business into code is not a simple feat.
No.
And you can give, you know, any of the models as much context, but you still, it needs the human guidance to do it. Mm-hmm. I do think that there's going to be a really interesting shift in how maybe junior devs learn to code. And there might be more of a responsibility of more senior members to kind of say, okay, these are the things that I learned that maybe your AI model won't teach you.
That will definitely be accelerated. I would be lying if I would say that I didn't learn a lot of C# features from using ReSharper for a long time, because that has basically already been giving on a very low level code suggestions. Like, hey, you might write these couple of statements in a different way or whatever. Now it's more reasoning about a bigger scope. We see AI reason about how classes are structured and whatever. We see more of that. And that's definitely going to help junior devs. But I also don't see AI replacing a junior dev on my team. It might get them up to speed faster. It might help them be productive faster. It might add to the team. It's not replacing people, soon at least.
No, and I still think that, you know, there's the human element, right? Mm-hmm. We call it artificial intelligence. And yet there's still so much about human intelligence that we can't define.
Right.
So, you know, how can we make a one-to-one replacement? Even if we tried to, it's going to fail. And I think even if we tasked out everything to some Jira board that had an AI integration with a chatbot model that said, right, go build this feature, I mean, the value that developers bring in uncovering pieces of the business logic that we hadn't thought of, or thinking more long-term strategy of how does this look in 5 years from now, or how do I hand it off to another developer, you're not going to get that same thing.
No. That's, well, at least not there yet. Maybe circle to one of the other things I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. We have seen some announcements for very significant AI investments that are going to happen soon. What effect are those going to have?
This is a fun week to answer that question. As we were talking about earlier too, DeepSeek is completely disrupting everything. And so for any viewers who might not have this information, and truthfully, this is kind of unfolding today
right
and as
now
we speak.
Yes.
So, and I haven't been able to read. So DeepSeek came from a Chinese company and they released a paper, I think it was just last week. There's about 11 pages, basically about how they took reinforcement learning on top of a large language model, were able to do some compression on the models to basically make it a little bit cheaper, faster. And there is claims that their benchmarks are going higher. I think today it's one of the highest apps on the App Store, and US tech markets are crashing.
Okay.
Yeah, fun. So me and tomorrow or in 2 days from now or in a week from now, we'll have more information for you. But I think it also kind of creates an interesting moment for us, is that this is going to keep happening.
Yes.
You know, we're going to have these little breakthrough bursts where something that we thought we needed a ton of money, you know, look at $500 billion has been invested into Stargate. I bet there's...
Will be invested at least.
Will be, maybe. Right, yeah. Now they're probably scratching their head saying, do we really need
How
that?
How are we going to come up with this amount of cash as well? Because it's big players, but it's still a tremendous amount of money.
It's a lot of money. And I think what I read on DeepSeek was that their previous model was $5.5 million for training. And, you know, we can guess perhaps a little bit more for what was actually released. But if you compare $5.5 million plus, you know, let's round up to 10, you know, just to be safe, versus $500 billion, that's a huge gap.
Yes.
So it opens the doors too for potential innovation outside of the big tech companies. Previously, if you really wanted to make an advanced LLM or a foundational model, you needed the big bucks. So yes, if you can now do the same thing, or even better, there's going to be a little bit
budget.
Is that
a shift that we're going to see? Is because, well, these very big models, they can do a lot of different things. If for everybody knows ChatGPT, it's a very generic model that can answer very different questions. Are we going to see more models that are perhaps smaller, cheaper to train, more performant when we run them, that are just as good at answering more narrow questions that are being asked?
Well, you're starting to kind of touch on the differences between artificial narrow intelligence, which is kind of where we are today, right? Yeah. AI that has been trained, models that have been trained for a specific task. Mm-hmm. And we have different ways of benchmarking each of these different tasks.
Right.
So most of the benchmarks that we're using right now to talk about ChatGPT, for example, are natural language processing mm-hmm. tasks.
Yes.
Now, AGI is the more generalized version, right? It can, you'll have one model that can do most of these things pretty well. ASI, artificial superintelligence, is where we kind of hope we never go. And there's...
That's Skynet level of intelligence, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We can, we won't speculate. But to answer your question, yes. So could we maybe even break down some of those price barriers to say, okay, give me a model that is specifically trained to do mm-hmm. this and be even better at ANI in this category?
I guess that's, to me as a developer, that's very interesting because mm-hmm. these big models, they are quite expensive to run. They take a lot of processing power. They're super expensive to train. I mean, mm-hmm. the average company doesn't have a budget to train them. But when you build them into a piece of software, you're probably only looking at a very narrow subset to answer a particular thing. Can we make that cheaper? Can we make it more environmentally friendly to do so? I think those are also like in the ethics debate, it's like, what kind of models are we using for what is still something that we definitely need to get a better grasp on because it's still very young.
I think that will, you know, that might be where that public trust conversation comes into play too, especially as we're, you know, still reeling from the wildfires in LA that I think last I looked, it was over 50,000 acres that were burned. And for context, the size of Manhattan is, I think, about 22,000 acres. So more than double the size of Manhattan. Yeah. And I have seen quite a few articles that are trying to draw a very straight line between growing AI usage and climate impact. They're very much adjacent. I think some lines have tried to weave them maybe a little bit tighter, but it is something that as consumers, we have to start asking ourselves, do we understand the environmental impact, my environmental footprint, just for interacting with a model like ChatGPT? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's siblings as well. And I'll be curious to see if maybe in a year from now, or hopefully sooner, or maybe a little bit later, if there's enough public interest on that conversation to be able to see what my usage is. And then it would fall a little bit onto the consumers to become really good at prompt engineering, right? Because if you have one person that can get the same answer in one or two prompts versus another person who might not have been trained or doesn't quite understand how to ask and prompt for what it is looking for, and it takes them 10 questions.
Yeah.
If you keep doing that, you're going to have a different energy consumption between the two.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, trying both as consumers, but also maybe as companies, elevating that information, you know, that's something we can all do together.
At least making people aware of what the impact is of their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to just find something on the internet, use Google and don't use an AI model to do that, right?
Unless it's already baked in.
So, okay, that's the investments that are happening right now. And we're going to see some very interesting times there. From a human perspective, the thing that scares me is especially when we see a war starting on gender in the US, that's something that's very fresh and that's definitely happening. If we are going to deregulate these models, we're going to see some models that are heavily biased. I don't want to be the doomsday thinker here, but I see a lot of risk there.
Yeah, so I often get named as the doomsday. You know, Michelle's coming to talk about ethics, dark cloud looming. And I really do like to clarify this, that I consider myself more of a pragmatic optimist. I wouldn't be in this field if I did not believe in the potential of AI to make lives better.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to get there, you know, simply because we wished for it or we hoped that we were going to get to that green pasture. It's going to be, you know, through intentional effort. Mm-hmm. And we have to be aware of the dark side. We have to be aware of the faults and, you know, how we get around them. You know, for the gender war that's embarking in the States, that's going to be another type of bias that we see. And we already have so many different models across so many industries, even more classic machine learning models that are driven very heavily by imbalanced data. In the field of fairness, I will bring this up. There's a data set. It's an old data set, and it's called the adult data set. You would never use this data set for anything other than the fact that it has many different protected categories. It has gender, and I need to call out that it only lists male and female. Mm-hmm. I believe this was assembled sometime in the 90s. It's like from census data in the States.
Right.
And it does try to represent other countries, but if you look at the spread, it is highly US dominated, a few other countries. There are great imbalances between, you know, race, between education levels, between different types of occupation. If you're working in the public sector, private, government, all these different aspects create quite an imbalanced spread.
Right.
And if you try and take this data set, and again, you would never do anything real with this data set other than to prove the point that this is what happens when you have bias and imbalanced data. Mm-hmm. The target feature is predicting if an individual makes a high income or a low income based off of a specific threshold that they set. And it doesn't take much to say, yes, this is biased. It, for example, on the female and male only available, you know, genders in the data set, the false negative rate for females to make over a certain income threshold is way off the charts as compared to the male counterparts. Right. But that still doesn't tell us the full picture, right? And so we're going to start getting these data sets that don't tell us the full picture. They tell us the filtered picture that maybe new regulation is imposing.
Right.
Or maybe that someone collected this data set without really having the full picture in mind of saying, did I represent this truthfully, or did I represent this how I interpret it?
Right. And it's like, as you mentioned, it is the nature of the source data that's going to determine the biases of the models that we train on them. But the source data is often coming from human systems that were biased to begin with, right? Detecting whether somebody would be a delinquent is something that they have done training on prisoners' faces. There was very heavy race bias in that one, but that was maybe caused by the fact that police tend to arrest more Black people. And just the awareness that we need to have as tech people when we advance AI is, I feel, something that there isn't enough push for at the moment. Are there any ways that if we are training models, if we are developing AI applications, that we can either measure bias or at least have a set of practices that we can apply to make sure that we're kind of balancing for the right thing?
Yeah, yes, and. So, you know, I'll go back when you brought up the source data. And that brings up another one of our conflicting values that we talked about earlier. And that would be transparency versus perhaps, you know, trade secrets of a company, right? Mm-hmm. They want to protect their IP. And maybe part of that is the data. You know, or maybe even we're in a situation with healthcare where it would be a breach of our users' trust to, you know, elevate this data into the public. And it makes it really hard from a few different angles. One is actually in procurement. So say you're a healthcare organization or a hospital and you're looking to procure some piece of technology. You would want reports, right, on the ethics. You would want a transparency report. You don't want to understand what type of data was collected, what has been done in terms of bias measurement, mitigation, and management.
Right.
And I think what we're going to start seeing is just a different life cycle of AI products. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, yes, we can measure bias. To date, I think there are I want to say it's like 26 or 27 different mathematical measurements of bias.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fun. So try handing that off to a team that maybe hasn't been formally trained in fairness and say, hey, go measure the bias in the system. And then they say, okay, how do I measure the bias in the system? Oh, crap. What metric do I use? Mm-hmm. And that becomes a training piece that, you know, from a corporate standpoint, if we are now self-governing and self-regulating, you need both, you know, top-down encouragement as well as bottom-up incentive. You can't have, you know, one or the other and not be successful. But yes, there's different ways to measure individual points of fairness, group fairness. You can seek to measure predictive equality without maybe ground truth. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, two individuals from two different attributes of a protected category apply for a loan, for example, do they have an equal chance of getting a positive outcome, assuming that everything else of their attributes are the same?
Yes.
Just the one thing that is different is the protected attribute. Do they have equivalence?
Mm-hmm.
That's one measurement, but that doesn't tell us the full picture because it just tells us the predictive parity, you know, of the model. What we really want to see is a balancing of ratios between false positives, false negatives across different groups. And in terms of, you know, mitigation techniques, there are several. I personally feel that we haven't really solved the problem. I will add on to that. There's no free lunch, right? There's no one rule, one model, you know, that will solve every problem. In some cases, there is just method of pre-processing. Did I measure this right? Have I compiled the data set correctly? Have I split it, you know, appropriately? There are methods in processing that seek to make the model itself aware of potential bias and almost like adversarially correct that bias during training. And there's some sort of half-assed attempts, you know, on the outer side of a company being like, okay, well, we're aware that this happened, so how can we alleviate options for this group?
Mm-hmm.
I think, yes, we need to continue those things, but also the continuous management of the life cycle of the product is going to be very important. So how do we create checks and balances in our process to say, have we measured this? What have we done to mitigate it? What sort of report can we generate to our stakeholders that say, yes, we've done this, and also these are things that we need to continue doing?
Because basically what ideally we want, and it's way more complex than a food label, but is a food label for an AI model. Like when you're buying this tool from us, the models that are in this, they apply to these criteria and they have these attributes and you can expect this from them, right? As a consumer, that's what I would want. I mean, it's far too complex to have something that simple apply to it. But that brings us maybe to the questions like, hey, if I, as a company, buy a tool that employs AI, I use that tool, one of my customers uses the tool that I've built on top of that, and something goes wrong somewhere, like a life is lost, somebody gets injured, like it's a very easy thing to reason about. Like, who's responsible? Because ultimately, that decision might have been made completely down the line by a tool that was purchased and then somebody else built on top of that. Like, accountability, that's definitely something that we need to worry about, don't we?
Yeah, and you asked a key question, like, who is responsible? And right now we're a little bit in the Wild West. You know, there's a myriad of different lawsuits to choose from on this topic. You know, there was a teenager who a few months ago, you know, commit suicide after a conversation with a chatbot. I believe the mother is pressing charges, and I'm not certain where that lawsuit has landed or if it's still in progress, but who is responsible? You know, is that, I think this particular instance was Character AI. So should they be responsible? Is it, you know, if we're talking about minors, should the parent be involved in how a child is using technology?
Mm-hmm.
Is the parent responsible? You know, you can go even further of what happens postmortem to your data that AI has been trained on.
Mm-hmm.
Who owns that?
Right. Is there any framework that is being used in the industry? Although even maybe like the courts haven't picked up on it.
Right. I think that there's quite a few individual attempts because of, you know, the lack thereof of overall governing bodies. I will always point back to NIST. They have done some really wonderful frameworks across quite a few different zones, including bias. Microsoft has also released their responsible AI standards. Quite a bit of the larger companies have been doing that. IEEE also has their set of, you know, ethical AI considerations. So you can kind of look right now corporate and academic, and there's work being done in that space, but we have a collapsed bridge that we have to build up.
All right. But at least it is something that is being worked on in the industry.
It has been. We'll see what the changes in the last couple of weeks bring us. I would be lying if I said I was not skeptical and worried. Yet there are still so many people that have been working in this space that are dedicated, that care about it, that are passionate. And, you know, I think that it might just fall upon individual shoulders a little bit more. But also there are so many wonderful people in this world that do care about what happens to humanity and how we're using our technologies. And I think it's just going to get more tense. But also the world has been very tense these past few years, and that does impact AI. Mm-hmm.
So a message of hope, basically, to conclude, like, humans are going to do the right thing, hopefully.
Yeah, I hope so. Here's the thing. If you look back at the last few thousand years of humanity, mm-hmm. you know, you can follow threads across the entire human history of, hey, this thing was new. This is what it changed. This is what we got out of it. Mm-hmm. It's usually good things. You know, there's mm-hmm. always conflict in there, but something good came out of it, right? And then we go into that next iteration. So we're in another type of revolution. This one is going to be so interesting because it's impacted by so many things other than just itself, right? We've talked about this geopolitical climate that's happening. You have this AI arms race between different countries, between different companies. You have, you know, public divisiveness in political landscapes. You have conflicting ideologies. And all of those things are impacting AI. Mm-hmm. So there's an individual responsibility, and I think sticking your head in the sand and, you know, saying it's going to go away, it doesn't apply to me, it's just not going to work in this one. So I think my challenge would be to find a use case that does excite you. Mm-hmm. Think about something that could make lives better. I would love to see, you know, for me personally, some sort of medical device that would read brainwaves and that would tell people if they're going to have some sort of medical, you know, emergency.
Right. Because what the audience doesn't know is that down here is Wilbur, yeah. who is your
service dog.
Your service dog, right?
Yes. So
you have a stake in this.
I do, and it's really frustrating. So as a consumer of, you know, medical care, and as a patient. And also, you know, as someone that works in AI, I've been super frustrating looking for epilepsy detection devices. Mm-hmm. That would be incredibly beneficial for me. However, I also want to see that there has been some sort of regulation and procurement process. I would want to see what the medical device, what kind of data it was trained on, what's happening with my brain data. It doesn't mm-hmm. get more personal than that, right? What could come out of that long term if I, you know, trusted a company with this data, but also what the benefits would be.
Right.
There was also a study last year that I still think is maybe one of my favorite things that came out of 2024 AI. And there was a neurological study in which they played Pink Floyd for, you know, a bunch of different people while their EEGs mm-hmm. were being read. And at the end of it, the model could predict what songs they were listening to.
Right.
The implications for that for, you know, people that have locked-in syndrome or that maybe aren't able to communicate effectively, mm-hmm. that's brilliant. Like, that would be wonderful. So we should be focusing on those things and maybe not some of the lower-level tasks. You know, some other things I could state that OpenAI has partnered with different companies to help people that are visually impaired. Mm-hmm. So that they know if their milk carton is expired or how to sort their laundry. Those are wonderful ways in which we can make people's lives easier. So for me, I think as technologists, we should be focusing on those use cases mm-hmm. and making a choice to work on those types of things.
But that basically holds true for any software system. It's like, work on systems that do something responsible. Because even before AI, we were able to do some very...
Don't be evil.
Yeah, don't be evil. I think that's a good statement to end this interview on. Like, don't be evil and use AI responsibly.
That's Google's slogan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll back that. Don't be evil.
Don't be evil. Thank you so much for joining me today, and thanks so much for talking about the ethics in AI.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.